Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to the Universe Next Door, where today we are turning our focus to the Cambrian explosion one more time and the news that's breaking forth in the discussion that has come out of the book, Darwin's Doubt. The author of that book is with us today. His name is Stephen Meyer. You are probably well familiar with that name because he's been a guest a number of times on the Universe Next Door program. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your incredibly busy schedule of traveling around, speaking, and even debating. I have just received word that the debate you had with the biologist, Dr. Carl Giberson, was quite an interesting encounter. And I would love to have you tell us a little bit about that. And some new discoveries are being announced from the Cambrian explosion. And your book, of course, Darwin's Doubt, is the leading go-to book in many people's opinion. I would say the world of paleontology, even those that embrace Darwinian evolution, many of them have to admit that the most authoritative book on this topic, from not only the fossil discovery, but the implications for Darwinian biology, is Darwin's Doubt. And in case you're interested, Darwin's Doubt is being carried around the world, of course, in every major book source. Amazon.com has listed, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 reviews, isn't it, Dr. Meyer?
We were at 448.
Approaching 500.
Not all of them good, though.
Don't
mislead your audience.
They're
pretty upset about it.
Some people will write an angry denunciation, usually two sentences long, often indicating they haven't even read the book. And then, of course, the ones who have read the book will often go on page after page explaining in detail how their lives have been enlightened and their knowledge of the Cambrian explosion has been so incredibly expanded. So thank you so much for joining us. Very quickly, I know that you have been following the Cosmos series, you and your team at the Discovery Institute. I might add that among the many hats that you wear is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute, but I know that you have been working with your team to monitor the pronouncements, the documentary MC role of Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, as he has been trying to reboot the Cosmos series along the lines of Carl Sagan 20-some or 30-some years ago. And I know that you guys have had some interesting inputs through your Evolution News blog. What is your take on this attempt, this Sunday night over the last, 6 weeks or so?
Yeah, they're through episode 6 now. Yeah. They'll have 13 episodes.
What is the theme that they're trying to couch or to maybe just slip under their rhetoric? And how do you see it working?
Well, there's, I think, two main themes that they're trying to establish, two main arguments, really. One is the idea that science properly understood supports a purely naturalistic or materialistic worldview. They start the program quoting from the original Sagan program, in which he said the universe is all there is and all there was and all there ever will be. And this is supposedly the message that we derive from a close study of the cosmos. I find it right out of the chute incredibly ironic, because the new cosmology has shown over the last 100 years that the universe is not eternal and self-existent and self-creating, but rather it is itself finite in time, not eternal, and the evidence for the definite singular beginning of the universe has actually provided the basis of reformulating one of the most powerful and ancient arguments for the existence of God, known as the cosmological argument. That is to say, the evidence for a finite universe seems to point to the need for a cause beyond the universe to bring it into existence. So they are clearly not just pushing a scientific agenda. They have a worldview that they're pushing as part of the series. The other aspect of what they're pushing is a kind of antiquated trope in the history of science, where they are presenting the history of science as a long sequence of battles in an ongoing warfare between science and religion, where religion is always the force that is suppressing free inquiry, suppressing science. And so in the process of doing that, they have made many errors of omission and commission, errors of omission in writing out the important role that Christianity in particular has played in the foundation and formation of modern science, from figures like Boyle and Newton and Kepler to the deeper assumptions that came out of a Judeo-Christian worldview, in fact, a biblical worldview about the nature of the physical world, that it was lawful, that it was intelligible, that it could be understood by rational agents who were made in the image of God. Those sorts of assumptions were part of the history of science and part of what gave rise to the scientific revolution. They've written that history out of the history of science, and instead they made a lot of errors of commission where they're misrepresenting historical episodes in order to try to show a conflict between science and religious belief that just doesn't exist. So those are the two main things. They're pushing a materialistic worldview, and they've adopted this kind of Enlightenment history of science, which tries to show that Christianity and science are at war.
With us today, Dr. Stephen Meyer. He is the author of Signature in the Cell, a very important book that came out in 2009 on the origin of life issue. It won a number of kudos, including a major award from a noted British newspaper consortium. And the result of that was a kind of fascination, Dr. Steve Meyer, that a certain atheist philosopher, Thomas Nagel, had with your work, specifically that book. I don't know if he's had a chance to interact with your other book, the newer one, Darwin's Doubt, but I think that's an indicator, would you say, of how things are loosening up and almost the lines are being redrawn and how people view worldviews, but specifically the Darwinian paradigm and how it's faring.
Well, I think a lot of the really shrill rhetoric that you're getting, including from places like this Cosmos series in which science is being presented as something which supports atheism. Yeah. And I think that's obviously a gross overstatement. I think that's actually a byproduct of people who have long claimed science in support of their atheistic or materialistic worldview, now recognizing that there is a lot of intellectual initiative on the other side of the argument. I think they're feeling somewhat threatened, and so what you get instead of engagement with the arguments is a redoubling of the really zealous rhetoric. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like if you run out of arguments, pound your fist harder on the table.
Pound the pulpit.
I think the new atheism as a phenomenon is actually an indicator that the Darwinian theory that underlies the new atheism is being challenged on so many different fronts that people are feeling the need to reassert the atheistic, materialistic, Darwinian worldview when there's so much contrary evidence, and that you have major figures like Thomas Nagel saying in his own book, quite separate from what he said about my work, He came out with his own book in 2012, Mind and Cosmos, subtitle, How the Materialist Neo-Darwinian View of Reality is Almost Certainly False. And so I do think that we're finding a lot of surprising openness to the arguments we've been making in quarters that we wouldn't have found it before. And I think that is making these very dogmatic new atheists and Darwinian atheists feel a bit threatened. And I think that accounts for some of the propaganda that's been coming out in places like this Cosmos series.
Very good. Again, with us today, the author of Darwin's Doubt, a runaway bestseller in the area of the fossil record. It's a worldview issue connection that we make all the time here on The Universe Next Door. We are dealing with universe issues, that is the mental universe, that are connected with the physical universe. And of course, the origins of the physical universe is part of our mental universe, our set of assumptions and beliefs, our worldview, our Weltanschauung. And Dr. Stephen Meyer trained in the philosophy of science at Cambridge University in England, where C.S. Lewis himself taught after he finished his career at Oxford and received that wonderful invitation to move over to Cambridge. We appreciate so much your joining us. And of course, your work is being featured now in a just released article through the Christian Research Journal?
Right. They've just come out with an article about the book. Well, they allowed me to author the article. In 3,500 words, I summarized the thesis of the book. And if people want to get a sense of what it's all about in the quick distilled way, they did a beautiful job of presenting the article with lots of great pictures and figures and things. And I think they have a pretty good circulation.
Very good.
So if you happen to get that journal,
excellent.
It's a good place to find out a little bit more.
And that's the one that's affiliated with, I believe, the work of Hank Hanegraaff.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Very good. Christian Research Journal. And we'll try to be able to feature that here on our own website, apologetics.org. We'll be right back on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today our focus again is on the fossil record and specifically the Cambrian explosion and a major leading light in the exploration and understanding of that message that is being sent to us from those strange and bizarre creatures that are swarming in the waters of the seas of the Cambrian. Dr. Stephen Meyer has been researching that area of science. Tell us about some of the discoveries that have been coming out. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it Fuxianhuya.
Fuxianhuya protensa.
Protensa.
It's an arthropod of Cambrian era. Very recent discovery. Paleontologists in China have been able to discern the evidence for the earliest cardiovascular system in an animal. And it's additional evidence of extraordinary physiological and anatomical complexity in the very first animals from the dawn of animal life. Mm-hmm. We have had already strong evidence of this in other arthropods. In particular, trilobites have compound eyes. In the last several years, the first fishes have been discovered going back all the way to the Cambrian. And so you have really extraordinary complex animal life that arises very suddenly in the fossil record. And this is the big mystery. Mm. It troubled Darwin in his day, and what I've written about in Darwin's Doubt. I've told the story of what happened to Darwin's Doubt about his own theory, which concerned this event called the Cambrian explosion. And I've shown that doubt has become very much more acute. And some of these recent fossil finds are part of the reason for that, because rather than seeing a gradual unfolding from very simple life forms to complex forms of life, what we get are complex animal forms arising very suddenly in the fossil record with a clear absence of ancestral precursors or transitional intermediates in the lower Precambrian strata. And that's contrary to what Darwin anticipated as far as his picture of the history of life. He envisioned the history of life as looking something like a slow, gradual branching tree. Instead, the picture is much more like a lawn or maybe an orchard of separate trees where the main forms arise very suddenly, geologically speaking. And then it's also contrary to what he expected about the way his mechanism of natural selection would work. He thought it would have to work very gradually because sudden changes in form would cause deformation in the existing forms of life, which would cause them to die out and terminate the evolutionary process. So he thought that variations had to arise very gradually and incrementally, but instead we see very big jumps and new innovations in form arising in the fossil record. Mm-hmm. And that's the first of the two big mysteries that I address in Darwin's Doubt.
In essence, we have not just an explosion of animal structure, we have an explosion of genetic information.
Well, that's really the second mystery, because Darwin, he knew about the origin of the new structure coming suddenly or abruptly in the geological record. He knew we had a problem of the origin of biological forms, new forms of animal life. But we now know that to build new forms of animal life requires new information. Information stored in the DNA, the genetic information, and other forms of information called epigenetic information that are stored elsewhere in cells and in developing animals. And I know you've written, you and your co-author, Dr. Jim Gills have written about this extensively. Mm-hmm. So we now know a lot about what it takes to build an animal. And the short answer is it takes instructions, it takes information. And so when we see an event in the history of life like the Cambrian explosion, where we see the explosion of cardiovascular systems or visual apparatus or whatever it is, we're seeing an explosion of information, all the information necessary to build those complex structures. And that's the really fundamental problem. How does the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection generate all that information? Mutations are copying errors in pre-existing sources of information. And insofar as the genetic information is stored in a digital form, we know a lot about what copying errors to digital information does. Those copying errors will degrade information. If you have a section of software and you start randomly changing the zeros and ones, you're going to degrade that information before you ever come up with a new operating system or computer program. And so as you get into the mathematics and the probabilities of this problem, and you say, well, what are the odds that random changes in genetic information are going to generate a new gene or a new protein? The odds are overwhelmingly against that proposition that random copying errors are going to generate something new and functional.
Yep.
And so you got some big problems. And I describe those at some length in the book Darwin's Doubt. There are four or five separate challenges that are coming out in the technical peer-reviewed literature to the creative power, the alleged creative power of the mutation selection mechanism. In other words, neo-Darwinism can't explain the information that is needed to explain the origin of all these animal forms in the history of life.
Well, what if the typical Darwinian reaction sets in that I've seen before? What if they say, well, I just won't go in the direction of some pre-existing mind or some cosmic magician, and they'll use some rhetorical put down or some kind of charged kind of, they use may word, may
pseudoscience, yeah, or religion masquerading as science, or creationism,
spaghetti monster, flying spaghetti monster.
This is equivalent to invoking a spaghetti monster.
Right. Yeah, so when it goes down, not the most biologists will go to that level. So this is maybe more bloggers. But how can we kind of capture the thrust of a scientific following the train out at that point?
Well, you know, actually a lot of even very serious biologists, they won't maybe use that kind of rhetoric, but they will say that considering a designing intelligence as part of the explanation for the origin of complex life, mm-hmm. complex animal life, mm-hmm. is just not scientific. It's non-science, or it's pseudoscience, or intelligent design, we'll hear, is just not science. And what I do to answer that objection is to take people back, ironically, to the method of scientific reasoning that Charles Darwin himself developed. Darwin developed a method of scientific reasoning for addressing these crucial questions of origins, because origins questions are essentially questions of history. They're questions about events that took place a long time ago in the remote past. And what Darwin did, and this was part of his genius, was he developed a method of scientific reasoning that could help us adjudicate competing explanations for events in the remote past. And his method of reasoning has a name. It's called the method of multiple competing hypotheses, or the method of inferring to the best explanation. And what this method does is it's essentially a forensic method. It looks at the clues that are left behind and then attempts to infer the best causal explanation for those crucial events in the remote past. So here would be an example. Over in Eastern Washington, where I used to teach at Whitworth University,
right,
there is a layer of white ash across the Palouse country where they grow the wheat. If you're a geologist and you didn't happen to be around on May 18th, 1980, you want to figure out, well, how did that ash get here? You'd use Darwin's method. You'd propose a number of different hypotheses. You'd say maybe it was a flood, maybe it was an earthquake, maybe it was a volcanic eruption. Now, which of those is best? Well, according to Darwin, the best explanation is the one that invokes a cause which is known to produce the effect in question, a cause which is known from our present experience to have the capacity to generate the thing we're trying to explain. So on that basis, using that criterion, the best explanation would be a volcanic eruption, because we've seen volcanoes produce layers of white ash, and we've never seen floods or earthquakes do that. Well, I applied that method of scientific reasoning to the question of the origin of information. And I asked myself a question: what is the cause of the origin of digital code, of information in a digital or typographic form, which is the very kind of information we find in DNA? And what we know from experience and from our present experience of cause and effect is that the only cause that we know of that produces information is intelligence, or a mind, not a material process, but conscious and rational activity. So when we see in the history of life these huge explosions of new information coming into the biosphere, as we do in the Cambrian explosion, I argue that we're looking at evidence for a designing intelligence. And in fact, that's a scientific conclusion, because we're using the very same method of scientific reasoning that Darwin himself pioneered. So when people say intelligent design isn't science, I want to point them to Darwin and say, no, we're using an established method of scientific reasoning.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for helping us with that conclusion. And Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt, a book that you must get and read. Thank you, Dr. Stephen Meyer. And thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door. I'm Dr. Tom Woodward. We'll see you back here next week.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.